I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
What keeps you up at night? Bills? Concerns about your family? The older generations? Or the younger ones? Your work, maybe? Well, it's no different for farmers. Except, what if your biggest worry is whether, as a fifth-generation farmer, you will be the one to lose the family farm? Welcome to Talk Farm to Me, the podcast that makes you rethink how you live with insights from a source you never knew you needed until now. I am your host, Dana DePrima. I am deeply committed to bringing farmers to you so that you can get to know them and what they face, to bring you closer to understanding the farmers in your own community. And I know whether you know them now or not, you want to, because your personal health depends on it. And your family's health, the health of your air and your water and your soil too, your community's economic health, and even national politics. Phew, seems like a lot to place on the shoulders of our farmers, but it's on our shoulders too. We want choices as consumers, and we are dangerously close to losing those choices. If small, local, and regional farming does not have our support, it will disappear. It is disappearing. That is why we're talking farm. It's something that once you start, you cannot stop. The dinner table, the water cooler, the cocktail party, and the voting booth. You want to be armed with a deeper understanding of your local landscape. And if that does not include farmers, it's weak. And your actions, daily, small actions like what you eat for breakfast, matter. You can take a small action and it can have a really big impact. I can show you. The fact that you are here now is one of those actions. Stay tuned until the end and I will give you 2 more. But for now, the fun part. You get to meet 2 farmers. They're married and raising kids on their farm that they share with their family. I met Laura and Mike Ellis of Mount Hope Farms in Oregon when Laura commented on a question I posed on Instagram about what worries you. Think of your own worry for a minute, that one that wakes you up at night. For Laura, it's being the generation that loses the family farm. It's heavy. But I want you to dig into the Ellis' story with me. Let me know if you think they will be the generation, the fifth one, that loses the family farm. In talking with Laura and Mike, where I felt really welcome to the kitchen table like we were old friends, I feel a sense of hope that is tied tightly to measured communication, research, trial and error, and optimism.
Mike's side of the family are fifth generation Oregon farmers. We're third generation on this particular piece of land.
Yep.
And right now we farm with his parents and us and our boys, and we grow a pretty diverse selection of specialty crops, seed crops, table grapes, berries, We also do a line of fruit spreads from berries that we used to grow all of them, and now we grow some of them and source from neighbors and people that we know and trust.
On my parents' part of the farm, it's primarily seed crops. So grass seed, clover seed, radish seed, a lot of that goes into the cover crop market. We also have a couple acres of table grapes, and that's the bulk of the stuff that we grow.
We do a lot of the things that his family has been doing for a very long time. And then he and I started our own farm business, Mount Hope Farms, which does the table grapes, the fruit spreads, things that are very different than what was normally done. So it's a mix of old and new.
I thought I would just chime in here as Mike and Laura exchange knowing glances across the kitchen table. Farming with family is hard, and the transition of a farm from one generation to the next is exponentially harder. According to the United States Department of Agriculture, around 97% of U.S. farms are family-owned. However, only about 20% of family farms survive to the third generation, and only about 10% make it to the fourth generation and beyond.
We're working together with family. We farm together, but we have our own part of the farm that we have ownership in.
Right.
And that was the same way my dad and my grandpa had done. They both had their own separate farms, but they farmed together and shared all the equipment. They worked together. And so it gives you a little bit of ownership and control of what you're doing, but you're still working with family too.
So there's some efficiency in that. You're sharing equipment and knowledge and labor when you need it.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. There's a lot of efficiency. There's a lot of, we're very lucky in that Mike's parents have been very supportive. Mm-hmm. Sometimes things can be challenging, as always, when you're working with family, but they've been very supportive of different changes. But for the most part, it's been working out well. We just have to figure it out year by year.
So I'm very curious. You guys are fifth generation and your kids are sixth. And Mike, it's your great-great-grandparents?
If I remember correctly, I believe it was my great-great-grandfather walked out here on the Oregon Trail with his family at the age of 8. And that's how far back we can trace it. They had settled down further south in the valley and they kind of bounced around over the generations. My great-grandfather was farming over in Cambie, which was the next town over. And that's where my grandpa grew up at. He was growing dahlias and breeding dahlias and flowers and did a whole mail order catalog thing throughout the Depression.
As a note for context here, the early 1900s saw the rise of mail order catalogs as a popular means of shopping for a variety of goods, including seed, plants, and gardening supplies. Companies such as Burpee and Sears and Roebuck Company were among the prominent mail order companies offering a wide range of products. Other more local catalogs, like this one, provided more specialized options, popular among gardeners.
They had some of the first irrigation in the country, and it was steel pipes that they had to move by hand to move irrigation around. He didn't like all the handwork. He wanted to get out and work with the equipment, with tractors. And so he rented ground in between Malala and Cambie and kind of gradually moved from one farm to the other, buying and selling farms until he landed on this one that we call home in 1962.
That's an incredible history. So who did you know and who was alive when you were little then?
I never got to meet my great-grandpa. He passed away when my dad was pretty young. But my grandparents on both sides, I grew up knowing them. Both sets of grandparents made it pretty late into life, upper 80s, early 90s, mid-90s in some cases. And so even when we moved back onto the farm to help out with my dad, our oldest was able to know my grandpa. He was still living here on the farm when we moved back in, and he still remembers my grandpa. And being able to play with him. So he grew up getting to know him. And as a kid, he would steal his cane sometimes and run around the house. And he has good memories of him.
Definitely good memories. And I didn't grow up with any grandparents. So it's been really cool to see him have that opportunity. And then every day he gets to see grandpa and grandma a lot of times because she does like the bookwork on the farm and she helps wherever she can and is able to. Mm-hmm. And it's just been really good to have them get that experience and get to know their grandparents and learn from them and really know that side of their history.
While we are talking about history, I would like to connect the dots on a little discussed element of family farming. We'll get to hear about it straight from the family farmers, but I wanted to pique your consciousness to the critical role of the farmer's wife. She's a farmer too, wearing many critical hats on the farm. Here's Mike on the memories of that role.
Going back to my great-grandparents, my great-grandma actually bred and developed a variety of pansies that they used in their mail order catalogs. It was the Oregon giant pansy that had a 6-inch bloom, just a giant pansy. In addition to doing the selective breeding for that, because she was the one that had the real touch with that on how to pick out the right ones that were going to breed true. She also would be up till midnight or working on the books and their marketing after the work for the day was done. And so they kind of split up the labor a bit that way. In my grandpa's era, my grandma did the book work for him and kept track of that. She also did all of the field meals.
Field meals seems obvious, but in order to keep the crew running, farm wives would and still do bring meals to the fields for the farmers. It's a physical break, a time to eat, and a social and morale boosting moment during a grueling day, usually one in a long line of grueling days.
So she would spend her time really cooking and making sure all the crew that was working out there was fed well. But she also jumped in trucks and would drive truck for them at times. And so she was doing work right there with them.
Well, and I know your dad speaks of her so highly because she did so much and was always involved, always taking care of other people. Like I know your grandpa told me a story once about how she went down to the pasture and there was a cow that was having trouble calving and she stayed out there and helped it and pulled the calf and did all of that on her own. So she was a very strong person. And I don't know if the farm could have functioned nearly as well without her help.
I love hearing these stories. And actually, I feel like we're like at the kitchen table. I'd love to meet all of these characters from history. Laura, I want to go to what you said to me. What if you can't keep the farm going as this fifth generation?
It's a worry. I think it's been a worry for every generation. It was a worry for Mike's parents. It was a worry about how they were going to pass it on. It was a worry that who is going to want to do this? Is anyone going to want to do this? And luckily, Mike was very interested, and this is what we really wanted to do. But there's always that worry of, are we going to be the ones that make a mistake with these new things that we're doing? Are we going to lose it for our kids? Are we somehow going to make it so Mike's parents don't get the rest that they need? Are they going to be able to do what they need to do as they age and get older? And we're just very conscious of that in every single decision that we make. And at first it was very exhausting and there was a lot of fear and there was a lot of anxiety. And a lot of times there still is, but it's gotten easier. And I think it's gotten easier as Mike and I have gotten more confident in our decision-making as we've learned who we are and learned more about what we want to do. Because I think when we first came back here, we knew we wanted to farm, but we didn't exactly want it to go the same way as what we had always seen.
My dad was very willing to accept change and move in a different direction. He had felt at times like he couldn't change things as much as he had wanted to when he was farming. And I love both my dad and my grandpa. They're great people, but everybody has flaws. And sometimes they didn't make the changes that needed to be made. My grandpa wanted things to stay very much the same, and he wanted to be supported with the lifestyle he became used to. And so with my dad, he knew the markets are shifting. We need to make some changes on the farm. We need to go a little bit different direction. So he was very supportive of looking into things like the grapes. That's a different cropping that has potential to be more profitable per acre. And that's allowed us to move the farm into a little bit of a different direction than what it always done, because when I was growing up as a kid, we grew one crop. And now this last year, we grew wheat for the first time in 10 years or so. We're growing grass seed, but for the forage market, for pastures, we're growing cover crop seed. We've just diversified into a lot of different things.
Just want to clarify and fill you in. Forage crops are primarily grown to provide feed for livestock. They're cultivated for their nutritional value and are an essential component of livestock farming systems. On the other hand, cover crops are primarily planted to cover and protect the soil during periods when the main crop is not growing. They're often grown between regular crop seasons, fall to spring, or during the off-season, to prevent soil erosion, improve soil fertility, suppress weeds, and enhance overall soil health. The forage and cover crop markets have experienced growth in recent years, largely driven by the increasing adoption of regenerative farm practices.
How are you making these decisions? Meaning, how are you deciding what to grow? Why table grapes? Why wheat? Why table spreads?
Quite honestly, when it comes to the major decisions, all of us sit down and discuss things and get on board with them. Before we ever put table grapes in out here, it was something that was discussed with my dad, and he actually brought forth that idea first off. He said, we have some old grapevines out here that grow juice grapes for our family. They've always done really well. We've never seen them really fail. I know somebody that's growing some table grapes here, another town or two over, that's selling some starts. Let's go take a look at this together. We spend a couple of years researching it, talking with them, getting information, going out there when the grapes were ripe, doing new pick, getting information on varieties. And it was really a collaborative decision. And every major decision we've made has been a collaborative decision where we all get on board. It may be one person's initial idea, but everybody gets on board with it before we really move forward on something.
And I think with the grapes, Oregon is very well known for its wine grapes, and that's become a big industry here.
Here's what big means. The Oregon wine industry is reportedly worth $330 million as of 2022, with Oregon being home to over 1,000 wineries, ranging from small boutique operations to larger, well-established estates. Oregon ranks fourth in the United States behind California, Washington, and New York. Big enough, right?
And people for a long time didn't think it could be done, and now it's a huge thing. And we wanted to go into something that wasn't already overly saturated, but something that was going to be familiar to people, that wasn't going to be like a hard sell, something that we knew we could sell direct to stores or direct to consumer, so we could keep most of the dollars on, and something that we already knew, like Mike said, there were already grapes growing out here, so we knew that they would do really well. And it's something that's unique in that the varieties that we grow are different than what you're going to see everywhere else, but people were comfortable trying it. And now we've got seasonal customers that wait to see them in stores, wait to see us selling them off the farm when we do that. And it's been really successful. You just kind of have to dive in and go for it with the best decision-making and discussion that you can do. And sometimes things work great, and sometimes they are a struggle.
Yeah. I do think that it is a tough conversation for multi-generational farms to bring up a change in any kind of a management practice, because the older generation, I've heard a number of times, well, I can't do this until my dad turns the farm over to me. I can't do this until grandpa isn't around anymore, because they won't put up with it. I never hear anybody say, why didn't the younger generation present this better? Couldn't they have approached it in a way that would have made it easier for the older generation to accept? Because any change to the farm is a change that maybe changing a practice that's been in place for generations. And you kind of have to take a step back and say, what is this really saying to my dad or my grandpa or the previous generations from me? Is this telling them that what they were doing was wrong? because it can be really easy to come across that way. Let's approach this in a way where we're being respectful to our previous generations, because if you don't approach it with the right respect, you're not going to have good success getting anybody won over to being supportive of that change. And if people aren't on board with the change, you're not going to be successful in making a change.
Yeah, that's really wise. And you're right. You don't hear a lot about the perspective that you're talking about, where there's a little bit of pressure and responsibility on the younger generation to, you know, step up and recognize where the farm came from and that it's hard to make change.
For us, the most important thing is relationships. We've talked about this so much that it's not only between, you know, our customers and us and stores and us, but it starts right here on the farm between my in-laws, between Mike's parents. You know, yeah. We want that to be a strong relationship because that's what matters. Mm-hmm. That's what you're going to take with you. And we want to model that for our kids because that's going to be a lifelong lesson for them. If our kids decide that this is what they want to do, they may decide to go a totally different direction. And I'm preparing myself to be okay with that now and be supportive and just keep that in the back of my mind, because mm-hmm. we've seen the benefits of people supporting us and then we've seen the pressures that come with this. So I hope that as we age, we can keep remembering this and keep that front of mind.
It sounds like you guys have some really good practices, some best practices in place from a family perspective, but also from like farm decision making. Sounds like you're pointing the arrow toward getting it to the next generation. What would be the biggest worry?
The biggest worry, I think, would be losing the farm. We really do believe that we don't want to pressure our kids into doing this. We want them to be the best versions of themselves and to do whatever is going to be good for them. But it is kind of heartbreaking to even ponder that thought of, well, maybe they won't want to do it, and maybe nobody else in the family will want to do it either, and then what happens? But in the end, we have the gift of being able to do this for however long we're here, and that's pretty special. But it's a fear, and it's a fear of letting people down. If something happens and we fail and aren't able to keep farming, it's hard to think about other people seeing that. It's a pride thing, but we know that we're doing the best that we can.
And I know another one of our worries too is when the time comes, whenever it gets transitioned, whether it be to our kids, to other family, or to somebody outside of the family, whoever takes it on, there's definitely concern there that we have it set up and structured in a way where it's set to be successful, because it is really, really difficult to take on any business that's sitting there floundering, that has all kinds of problems that you have to correct and change. We really want to make sure it's thriving so that it's attractive for somebody to come into. It's looks like something that family would want to come into and help support, but also that it would be set to be supporting any family that would come into it.
But can you tell me where you are? Like, what's the community like? I feel like you have a very strong family community, but I'm curious what's going on around you, what kind of farms, and what else is going on there?
Well, the nearest town to us, Malolo, it was a logging community originally. But in the 80s, logging really took a downturn, and we lost a number of mills. It's since regrowing, but it's becoming more and more of a bedroom community for Portland. A lot of people living out here, commuting into the Portland metro area for work. But there's still a lot of old families that have been out in this town for generations upon generations, especially in the farm ground outside of town. The neighbors all around us here, we know most of their families going back two or three or four generations. So there's still a lot of fairly tight-knit community in the countryside out here where most all of the farmers know each other. In some cases work together, in some cases not been as friendly a neighbors, but that's any community.
Malala has been changing very fast. And mm-hmm. for a long time, yeah. Portland was growing quite a bit. And like Mike was saying, it was a lot cheaper to live out here and drive the 45 minutes to an hour into Portland, because a lot of people were coming up from the San Francisco Bay Area. And so that commute really wasn't much to them. They were used to that kind of thing. And so it's changed in that we've got a lot of new faces, and it's wonderful when they stick around for quite a while and get integrated into the community and get to know everybody and the same.
And the other farms, what are they producing near you?
Oh, there's quite a bit of diversity. Grass seed has always been a real mainstay for the Willamette Valley in general. Specialty seed crops of any number of varieties are a real mainstay because we have a climate that's a Mediterranean climate type. It has a real dry summer where you don't get hardly any rain. And that's really essential for producing really good quality seed and getting it harvested well. So right next to us, a neighbor of ours here joining one of our fields has greenhouses, and they sell plant starts for farms, for commercial plant starts, transplants. And you'll also see broccoli, cauliflower, sweet corn, green beans. There's vegetable packers in the area that are buying and contracting all of that. There's onions being grown out and around us, grass seed, obviously, clover seed, cover crop seed, turf seed, and then a whole lot of specialty vegetable crop seeds, your brassicas, radishes, things like that, as well as hazelnuts have been a big player recently. The acreage of those has been expanding rapidly. Blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, strawberries.
I think we're one of the top, if not the top grower. We're one of the only growers of Marion berries, maybe the only commercial growers of Marion berries. I'm not sure. Maybe Washington has that too.
Oregon has the majority of them.
Yeah, in the U.S. The climate is just really special. A lot of neighbors grow cane berries, so the blackberries, raspberries, things like that. And we have a certain number of those on our farm as well for family use. The area is just so diversified in what you can grow and what does well here.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible. And that's been hard too, in some ways, to see the farmland getting eaten up by, you know,
housing and industrial use. Yeah.
That's hard. What do you do in terms of your customers? You say you're direct to consumer, but also to some stores. What's your market like?
For our table grapes, we grow them here, obviously, and then we deliver straight to specialty grocers. So like New Seasons Market, Market of Choice in the Portland area, all local specialty grocers. And it's a short season. We deliver for the month and that's it. And then with things like our fruit spreads that we make from fruit that's grown here and from neighbors, we also sell those in stores and off of our website. And we're slowly working on putting in like a farm stand and such out here. We just really think the more direct we can be, the better. It's better for us. And I think it's better for the consumer because they can talk to us and we can really communicate what's wonderful about our products. If they have questions, we can answer them and they can really get to know us and our story. And they feel really good about it. And we feel really good about it.
Well, and also for the grapes and everything that we're doing more direct to consumer, it allows for a level of transparency that is pretty unparalleled because we can open up the farm right before grape harvest and have grape days. We've been doing that, letting people come out, tours, see how we're growing them, talk with us on our farming practices. When we move over to the seed crops, those are handled a lot more like a commodity. When we harvest them, we take them into a seed cleaner. They're all commercially cleaned and then tested for the germination rate, how many seeds will germinate.
Quickly here, the germination rate refers to the percentage of viable seeds that successfully sprout and develop into seedlings under optimal conditions. It's a measure of the seed's ability to germinate and establish healthy plants. Seed sellers, including seed producers and distributors, need to offer products with high germination rates to remain competitive in the market. Seed buyers, like farmers, are more likely to choose seeds that are known to have reliable germination performance. There are other tests, but this is a big one.
The purity, and so they run it through a slew of tests to look for any other crops, weeds, anything like that. And by law, you have to have that on the tag to sell it. And then it's marketed through third parties out to seed dealers and distributors. because when we're hauling in hundreds of thousands of pounds of seed, your everyday homeowner isn't going to want to deal with those kind of quantities. Even a 50-pound bag is overwhelming to most homeowners and small-scale growers. And then grains, if we grow any wheat, that gets marketed either through our local feed mill or directly into Portland, where it's put on container ships and shipped around the Pacific Rim.
And when you're talking to your consumers, they're appreciating the transparency. What are some of their main questions?
We do a lot of demoing in stores, especially this time of year for when we're selling like our fruit spreads. And I would say like the same questions come up for them as the people who do like the vineyard tours and the buyers mm-hmm. for the grapes. And they want to know if they're grown organically. They want to know if we use any chemicals. They want to know if we're regenerative. Mm-hmm. They want to know our family's history, how long we've been here, how we help the community. We actually get that question a lot, how we contribute back to the community. They want to know more about their food, and they want to know what makes it different than like just going into a store and buying a Red Flame grape from California. Like, what makes this different? And usually if they can taste it, they can see the difference there. But before they do that, they need to know what makes things different, why we're special.
There's a lot of pressure on farmers who sell direct to consumers to answer a lot of questions. And then in a grocery store, customers buy whatever there is without any questions. It's an amazing contrast.
And so we do a lot of education about that through demos, through our website, through social media, and a lot through in-person events too, yeah. which are starting to come back more in our area.
So give me a little overview of your practices and how you would answer those questions.
In terms of growing on the grapes, they're certified organic. The rest of our seed crops are not. They're still conventionally grown. However, we've implemented a lot of organic practices and inputs onto those and have reduced the amount of fertilizer and chemistry that we use on those to be more sustainable, more regenerative in how we're going about it. The grapes specifically, though, we use a combination of our cultural practices, the trellising that we use, how we remove leaves around the clusters and straighten clusters, to improve airflow. We use that to mitigate fungal disease that can outbreak in there.
Trellising in grape growing refers to the practice of providing a support structure for grapevines to provide optimal vine growth, canopy management, and fruit exposure. You can probably visualize a vineyard planted in nice, neat rows with the vines attached to a supporting trellis structure and the leaves trimmed well along that row for optimal growth and harvest. I love how vineyards look, all neat and tidy.
Because our biggest issue with those for disease is powdery mildew. It likes a moderate humidity, and it likes a moderate temperature, and it does not like sunlight. So if we can manage the canopy in a way where we get some sunlight in there, we get some airflow in there, we keep that temperature from being sitting right at 70 or 80 degrees, which under a full canopy in the shade, it'll sit there all summer long like that. So we let a little bit of light in, we let some airflow in, and we try and make that climate inhospitable to the fungal infection. We also use some organic certified, they're classified as a fungicide. What it actually is a plant immune system booster to help the plant naturally get its own immune system up and going into high gear so that it can fight off any disease or issues that it has. And so going through and talking with people and being able to walk them through the vineyard, show them exactly what we're doing and why, that gives them a good idea of what we're doing management practice wise.
I think maybe a good short way to answer that too is like we do things as naturally as possible for mm-hmm. all of our crops. And we keep moving towards that. So the whole farm is no-till.
Tilling in farming refers to the mechanical manipulation of the soil to prepare it for planting, manage weeds, and improve soil structure. The process involves breaking up, turning over, or loosening the soil to create a suitable seed bed. Tilling is a traditional agricultural practice that has been used for centuries. In recent years, there has been increased interest in reduced tillage or no-till farming practices which aim to minimize soil disturbance. These practices seek to maintain or enhance soil health, reduce erosion, and improve overall sustainability in agriculture. The choice between tilling and no-till often depends on factors such as climate, soil type, crop type, and specific farm management goals. And at Mount Hope Farms, this one other exception.
The only exception we had a few years back was we had an outbreak of moles and gophers in one of our fields that we rented, and they did not respect the whole no-till thing. And it got to the point where we were forced to bring a few tillage tools down and smooth it back up because they had
tilled it for me in a bad way.
Yeah.
But we try and be as natural as possible with everything we do. And that's one of the changes, I think, for our generation, too, is we're recognizing and we're seeing more of, I think, all of the generations before us were doing the best that they could, and they were really good farmers. And I just think we're learning as we go. And a lot of the practices, we're kind of going back to more natural. And luckily, you know, like Mike's parents have been very supportive of that. But for me, when I'm living on the farm, I want to live in an environment that's as natural as possible, where there is as little chemical use as possible. That's really important to me and my family. And so when we grow things, that's what we're going towards and what we're doing, if at all possible. And then when we're making things like our fruit spreads, that's also what we do. So it's, and that's key for our customers too.
And when we source fruit from neighboring farms or from farms that we know and trust, we also look for those same practices and those right. same standards.
And that's where the relationship becomes so important too, is we have to be able to trust them and see what they're doing, and they have to be very open. Because when we're sourcing something from them and not growing it ourselves, I want to know how it's being done. And luckily, we've worked with people for a long time now, and it's been a really great thing. It's been wonderful to get to know people and build stronger relationships through our business. And we're really proud of how we're doing things and the direction that we're going. And we just always hope it's the right way, but I think that it is.
Mm-hmm. I'm very interested in this dance, the farmers and the consumers together, because I think, for example, when there are issues in agriculture, big ag, or raising livestock, or whatever it is, that people feel like they don't have a voice or a way to make it better. And so I am constantly saying, like, the egg carton does not say cage free or organic or any of those things because it wants to. It says it because consumers asked for it. And I love that you guys are having those conversations. And I'm just curious what you guys think of that give and take.
Oh, it's essential to have those conversations with your customer. I came out of a conventional background, and so I was reluctant about going towards organic. I needed to see that I could do it successfully and have a good, healthy crop, because I feel very passionate about my calling as a steward of the land, caring for it and looking after it. I wanted to make sure I could do that properly and still be in compliance there. But early on, when we were talking with our first grocery store that we got into with the grapes, he said, I know that you're not certified organic yet. You really need to look at doing this because that is what our customer wants. And there's going to be more people jump into this. You need to do this so that you're differentiating yourself from the other people that jump in. Great produce buyer, great friend of ours, and gave us great advice. And that really gave me the nudge to start looking that direction, was that direct feedback from not necessarily the end user, but the person that we were dealing with that was buying our grapes for his grocery stores. Farmers want to produce a crop that the consumers want to buy. So we need to get out there and talk with them and find out what they want so we can produce what they want.
I think it's been positive too, because sometimes some of the language out there for like organic or regenerative, things like that.
Regenerative ag has become a bit of a buzzword. You've heard it, right? At its core, regenerative farming is an approach that goes beyond sustainable farming practices by actively working to improve and restore the health of the entire farming ecosystem. The primary goal is to regenerate and enhance soil health, promote biodiversity, and improve the overall resilience of agricultural systems. This approach recognizes the interconnectedness of soil, plants, animals, and the environment, and seeks to optimize these relationships for long-term productivity and environmental health. Its practice comes in many forms along a spectrum and is the talk of the most innovative practitioners.
Sometimes they can mean a lot of different things to different people, and being able to discuss them from our point of view has been really good for us to understand more about our story and what we're trying to do. It teaches us the more and more we talk about it, but it also helps educate them.
Yeah. Well, a good example that I would say is the what we did with our signage for the grapes on the locally grown. We got to talking with different produce buyers in different stores, and they said some places' definition of locally grown is 24-hour shipment from wherever it's at to the store. And we said, that could be halfway across the country. So on all of our grape signage, we made a point of making it up for each store location. You know, proudly grown this many miles from this store. And I said, okay, anybody can say local. This is what we mean when we say it's local for you. It's grown this far away from you.
I've been really trying to help people talk to farmers. You must know a farmer. It will change your life. And I think this is what I'm talking about. Meaning, it's so lovely to talk with you guys. But if I'm your customer and we're talking and I'm like, well, I like my grapes this way, or I really won't buy grapes unless they're like this. And people need to feel like they're part of we're part of the chain. We're all part of the chain, all of these, you know, all of these elements, and we've got to feel that power. But the idea is that curious, interested, concerned individuals get an opportunity to meet a farmer in a way that you can't necessarily meet at a farmer's market. I'm interested what you want to say to people who are not farmers. What is something that's really important that you want them to do?
From my perspective, it's to really get exactly what you said, to get to know your farmer, and then you will know your food. Get to know them, ask questions. Just asking questions is a way of supporting us, whether that be on social media, whether that be in person. And getting to know us, getting to understand why we do the things that we do and why we need to grow things the way we need to grow them, and getting to know exactly what they're supporting and who they're supporting. I think that's just, it's going to be so important, especially as we go into the future and as we see in our local area things starting to grow. Getting people to support local and know us is going to keep us going. And it's going to keep us going for generations. If our family decides to keep doing this, or whoever takes over the farm, that's going to be key, because we're not going to grow a lot more than what we already are in a lot of ways. Yeah. We just need to be able to take what we have now and use it really well and get to know our customers and continue getting their support.
It's just essential. Get to know the farmers in your area. Even if they don't provide you with every last bit of food that goes on your dinner plate, the more farmers that you talk to, the more farmers you know, the more you're going to understand about what's showing up there. And quite honestly, most people are eating 3 meals a day. You're interacting, whether you realize it or not, with farmers 3 times a day. Get out there and get to know them so you know what's going on with that. And it's going to be good for them, because honestly, farmers need to get to know their customers better too, so that you know what you're producing for, and realizing you're producing food for people. It changes your perspective on what you're doing, and it changes your idea of what your standards are going to be when it's food for somebody's table or a commodity going to an elevator.
Get to know your farmers. Yes. Do you? If you want to connect with a farmer near you and you need a little guidance, just let me know. I'm always happy to point you in the right direction. Today, that direction was toward Oregon. Just outside of Portland, at Mount Hope Farms at the kitchen table of Mike and Laura Ellis, with a spunky little rooster right outside the picture window. Did you notice him? Talk Farm to Me is one of the best ways to get to know some farmers. It is hard to get them to sit still long enough to get into it pretty much anywhere else. That said, there's no replacement for knowing and supporting the farmers in your own community who put the food right on your very own dinner plate. I know one thing's for certain, that persisting question, will we be the generation who loses the family farm, is relevant for all family farmers across the United States. It has to be. Farmers have to work harder than ever to keep the farm from going under. The challenges come in many forms. You can talk about those with your farmer, and you can be the one who makes those challenges less threatening. At the top of the show today, I promised that I would share with you two ways that you can take a small action to support your farmers. One of them is to sign the Four Farmers Pledge, and the other one is to send a thank you to a farmer you know. It will trigger a series of thank yous, including a care package being sent to them. You can find both of these small actions on the FourFarmersMovement.com website. Thanks for being here. I am your host, Dana DePrima, and this is Talk Farm to Me, the podcast that makes you rethink how you live with insights from a source you never knew you needed until now. Talk Farm to Me is produced with new and skillful co-production from Sonia Dillon and sound design by Russell Chapa. Thanks for being here with our farmers, and see you next time for a visit with another farmer, maybe in your backyard.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.